This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiya Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So Nigerians are full of hope. They want this present government to go. People are tired. They want to see a change. They hope that Tinubu and his vice, Hashim Shettima, will bring change.
That's VOA Hausa Service Abuja Bureau Coordinator Medina Dauda on Monday's swearing-in ceremony of Bola Tinubu as Nigeria's new president. Details coming up. Also, a Somali official reports heavy casualties after Al-Shabaab attacks a base at the AU peacekeepers camp, and the fighting in Sudan has destroyed hospitals and medical care in the country. All these and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Witnesses say there is fierce fighting between rival Sudanese forces today in the western region of Darfur, although United States and Saudi Arabian observers noted improved respect for a fragile ceasefire now in its fourth day. The one-week truce is the latest in a series that were all violated, with the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces accusing each other of more breaches this week. The U.S. and Saudi monitors reported particularly serious violations on Wednesday. The conflict, which erupted on April 15th, pits Sudan's de facto leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, against his former deputy, RSF Commander Mohammed Hamdan Dagalo. The conflict has killed nearly 2,000 civilians. The United Nations says more than 1 million people have been displaced within Sudan, while about 300,000 have fled to neighboring nations. In towns and cities, food, water, and power outages are widely reported. The International Committee of the Red Cross yesterday said it finally had been able to begin distributing aid to hospitals in Khartoum. The fighting in Sudan has destroyed hospitals and medical care in the country, and patients who fled the conflict are desperate for treatment. In the absence of medical aid, a Sudanese pharmacist who fled the country in recent weeks is doing what he can to help other refugees at the camp in neighboring Chad. Henry Wilkins reports from Kofron, Chad.
A month ago, Mohammed Adam gathered what medicine he could when he heard the Janjaweed, an armed group known for killing civilians, was about to storm his hometown of Tindelti in West Darfur. He says he loaded the medicine on a horse-drawn cart and rode the kilometre or so across the border to neighbouring Chad. Since then, he has set up a makeshift pharmacy in Kafrun, a refugee site where about 10,000 people live. He says they are most in need of medicine for children because kids are getting sick with infections, diarrhea, coughing, and especially measles. He says most of his patients are children. He says he pays for the medicine his patients receive himself. Medina Ahmed Ishak has just arrived at the pharmacy seeking treatment for her baby, Abdul Razak. She says that Abdul Razak is sick with malaria and diarrhea, and that any food they had is now gone. They don't have enough to eat, yet she prays her son will one day grow up to be a doctor. Since Sudan's conflict began on April 15th, Chad and aid groups have struggled to provide enough food for refugees to eat. Medical aid is scarce too, according to refugees. Inside Sudan, the healthcare system has all but collapsed. This video purports to show a hospital in Khartoum gutted by the fighting. Others in the city are said to have been severely damaged, along with hospitals in West Darfur, where much fighting has taken place. The medical non-profit Doctors Without Borders said Tuesday that its medical facilities had been looted, while a staff member had already been killed in April in the fighting. It says the looting will have life-ending consequences for the Sudanese people. Amir El-Tom is the Assistant Secretary General of the Sudanese American Physicians Association. He says with the Sudanese government not functioning because of the fighting, his organisation is helping fund the running of some hospitals. A week-long ceasefire that began Monday should allow some medical aid to enter the country.
Some of the hospitals that have been shut down for various reasons are the largest in Sudan, some of the tertiary hospitals that other states referred to. Basically, the fighting has to stop. Otherwise, one catastrophe after the other in different or various fields of medicine will ensue.
Adam says refugees need more help from the international community, however. He asks all non-profits and local communities to help the refugees because they really need it. They have no place to protect themselves from the rain, which helps spread diseases. He is also concerned about the spread of cholera, which could turn into an epidemic, which would be catastrophic. He says he's doing what he can with what little he has. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kufrun, Chad.
Al-Shabaab militants in Somalia today attacked a military base housing Ugandan forces of the African Union peacekeeping mission. Al-Shabaab is fighting to topple Somalia's government and establish its own rule based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. The militants attacked a base belonging to the African Union Transition Mission in Somalia, ATMIS, in Bulmarar. Residents of the town said they woke up to the sound of explosions and heavy weapons. A Uganda People's Defense Force confirmed the attack but had few details. ATMIS says Al-Shabaab hit the base using car and suicide bombers and that airborne reinforcement from the mission and its allies destroyed the militants' weaponry as they withdrew. ATMIS gave no details on casualties. Al-Shabaab claimed it killed 137 soldiers, but those numbers could not be confirmed. Reuters News quoted a Somali army captain saying the militants also targeted an adjacent base belonging to the Somali military. He reported a fierce battle for hours with heavy casualties on all sides. Nigeria's president-elect 70-year-old Bola Tinubu won the presidency of Africa's most populous nation with 8.8 million votes, according to final election results. Despite lingering questions about his health and past corruption allegations, the two-time Lagos governor will succeed President Muhammadu Buhari on Monday when he is sworn in. Earlier today, I spoke with VOA Hausa Service Abuja Bureau Coordinator Medina Dauda about the preparations for the inauguration and the mood of the country regarding the changing of the guard.
I will not want to say the entire nation, yes, but the Federal Capital Territory of Nigeria is wearing a new look entirely. Everywhere is being painted, flowers are being put on trees. It's looking so beautiful. Everyone that comes as a stranger will know that something remarkable is going to happen. The government is ready for all of this.
How about the mood of the people?
Well, the mood of the people are happy seeing something happening. People are really happy that there's going to be a change in government.
You know, Monday, the ceremony is important not just for the ruling party, but also for the people of Nigeria, because it will pave the way for the incoming administration of the president-elect. But there is a court case still not resolved. Should the swearing-in go on while the court case is still pending?
Yes, the swearing-in will still go on even with the court cases pending. If you remember what happened in 2003, 2007, and even 2011, when the outgoing president, Muhammadu Buhari, attempted to be president three times, and three times he failed. He took 50 months of going to court to challenge the government that was sworn in. So it is a constitutional thing for this country that so long as elections held and somebody was proclaimed a winner, that swearing-in must take place. But again, it will not stop the constitutional aspect also that gave all the opposition the right to challenge this victory in court.
Buhari steps down next week. Many are saying he'll be leaving Nigerians less secure, poorer, and more in debt than when he came to office in 2015. Because when he came to office, he was riding a wave of optimism that change was possible. He was supported by a powerful coalition and had the reputation of being a hard man soldier who would get things done. Did he get things done in the last 8 years?
There is no government that will come to power that may not change one or two things, even if we don't see it. Of course, government is a continuum, yes. Agreed that analysts are saying, even though he met a country in total insecurity, because when he came, people hardly go to church, people hardly go to mosque, because bombs were being detonated in prayer places, in the markets, in the motor parks. Now that has reduced. Analysts are giving him a pass mark in that aspect. He has actually tamed the major one, which is the Boko Haram.
Something positive. So let's go on. Let's talk about Asiwaju Bola Ahmed Tinubu. He's believed to be one of Nigeria's richest politicians, and he will be sworn in on Monday.
From what we saw of his handiwork when he was the governor of Lagos State, so many positive things happened in Lagos State, that Lagos has become one state that can depend on itself, even without government revenue going into their purse. To rule a state is different from ruling the country. Agreed that everybody who wants to contest as president and eventually wins will be given the chance to rule the country, so that we see what that person can do. What kind of change will he bring to the country? How would the economy be during his tenure? How would the insecurity be during his tenure? Everyone is hoping that there will be a change. So Nigerians are full of hope. They want this present government to go. People are tired. They want to see a change. They hope that Tinubu and his vice, Kashim Shettima, will bring change and succor to Nigerians when they take over from Monday.
That's correspondent Medina Dauda. She spoke with me from Abuja, Nigeria. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Zimbabwe officials hope vaccinations will tame a cholera outbreak as citizens continue to drink unsafe water. As Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, authorities are urging people to practice good hygiene to contain the waterborne disease.
Zimbabwe Minister of Health authorities say that cholera has claimed 28 lives since the end of April. Nearly 400 cases have been confirmed and more than 1,400 cases are suspected. Health organizations such as the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights blame the outbreak on the consumption of unsafe drinking water and the flow of sewage in some areas. Jacob Mafume, the mayor of Harare, says he is aware of drinking water and sewage problems.
We are responding to sewage issues as soon as we get a report on them. We are also increasing the water flow. We are also going to take advantage of the polio vaccination to vaccinate against cholera. Because most of the people who are getting this cholera are unvaccinated people.
Zimbabwe received heavy rains this year and most of its water sources are full. But clean water for drinking and household use is not getting to most citizens' homes because of power cuts and shortages of water treatment chemicals. Fanuel Mushonga says he has not had tap water in his home for 3 weeks. He says he is lucky to have a manual borehole nearby. Mushonga says, if I could get a chance to talk to leadership, I would plead with them to train our students studying to be engineers so that they could pump water from Lake Chivero to the people in townships, and also to procure water treating chemicals so that people drink safe water, he says. Citizens should practice good hygiene and the government should do more to treat water and inform citizens, says Dr. Norman Matara, Secretary General of the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights.
We urge the government to continue the surveillance that they've been doing over the past weeks and over the past months so that we detect new epicenters of cholera outbreak. We also urge the government to continue with mass media awareness on the cholera outbreak and on ways people can prevent this cholera outbreak within their homes. But as a permanent solution to prevent the recurrence of these cholera outbreaks, we urge the government to continue supporting the treatment of water within our cities and within our towns. We've seen mayors complaining that they do not have enough resources.
The health organization says the extremely virulent disease is now in 13 African countries. Dr. Otim Patrick Ramadan is the World Health Organization's Regional Health Emergency Officer. He says that hygiene is not enough and that governments must provide clean water and hygienic facilities to eliminate the problem.
That is something that requires a lot of investment and that governments need to proactively work on. Then the second one, of course, is also addressing issues of hygiene of food in, at the community level, at the household level. And then working, because we have communities or areas where cholera has been endemic, and we need to have targeted interventions in those areas.
In 2008 and 2009, a cholera epidemic killed more than 4,000 people in Zimbabwe. According to a U.S. report, the crisis was exacerbated in part by the politicization of water, health, and aid. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
For basketball fans, the big day is almost here. Tomorrow, Senegal's AS Douanes takes on Al Ahly from Egypt in the finals of the Basketball Africa League. On Wednesday, AS Douanes shocked favorites Angola's Petro de Luanda 92-86. Al Ahly knocked out Mali's Stade Malien 78-73. After the game Wednesday, AS Douanes guard Jean-Jacques Boissy described his feelings.
I'm actually really, really happy, like, not just because of my performance, but because not offensively, but like defensively. Like I said this last interview, I was like, I wanted to get the best player in every team, and like right now I'm super proud of myself because I could like play good defense on Morais or either solo, so I'm so happy about that. On the free throw line, I think like it's called free throw, so whenever I miss one, I'm even mad at myself. So I'll be like, it's easy points. I want to score, so I make sure I try to focus a lot and make them. And it was clutch, and I had to make them.
Al Ahly shooting guard Ahoub Imen says the team's experience will help it to be ready for tomorrow.
For us as a team, I think that's one of our advantages. We played a lot of finals. Coach, we've been in these situations before. On the winning side and on the losing side, we just came from the finals of the Super League in Egypt like less than a week ago. All the games were very tough and very close, so I think we're a very close group. And even Nuni, Corey and Michael that haven't been us all year came together with us, and I think that's a great advantage for us that we've been through a lot together.
Al Ahly and AS Douanes face off tomorrow in the BK Arena in Kigali, Rwanda at 1600 UTC. You'll be able to catch tomorrow's championship game on voaafrica.com and wherever you listen to VOA. Teachers from 115 schools in the Mozambican province of Manica are creating their own teaching material using cardboard, plastic, gallon jugs and bags made from raffia leaves offered by the community. They say they are saving money by replacing expensive conventional teaching material while helping the environment, in this story narrated by Barbara Santos.
In the interior of Mozambique, more often than not, the school year starts with a shortage of books. Resourceful teachers from some schools in Manica started transforming garbage into teaching tools. First grade children learn while they play, explained Constantino Bacachesa, who teaches at the school.
People buy cooking oil containers, then we pick it up, wash it, and transform it into teaching material.
The schools in Manica are recycling plastic containers and cardboard and turning them into cutout items, allowing children to learn numbers, letters, and syllables. Bacachesa says he uses a sharp knife to carve out the letters and numbers. He said it allows children learn by playing and has had a major impact on the development of young minds.
When children in a classroom don't have their own material, they are not motivated. But when they see this material, it's marvelous. It really helps them learn how to read, to write, even with math. For example, they learn the numbers and how to count. Some first graders don't know how to read the numbers, but when they see how they look, they learn how to write them down.
Sitting on the floor on tiny benches made from eucalyptus and pine tree trunks, the children are given what teachers call a soup of numbers and letters, which they use to count and build simple words.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been 40 years since the United States created the Anti-Terrorism Assistance Training Program. At a press briefing, Julie Kabus, U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary and Assistant Director for Training in the Diplomatic Security Service, noted that since its creation, the ATA has delivered counterterrorism training to over 160,000 students in 150 different countries.
Last year alone, ATA trained nearly 5,000, about 4,700 students in approximately 47 different nations. Since its inception, ATA has represented a true partnership across the State Department, focusing on the global challenge of helping nations combat terrorism and confront terrorism.
The ATA program is the combined responsibility of the State Department's Bureau of Counterterrorism and the Diplomatic Security Service. Gregory Legerfo, Deputy Coordinator for Regional and Multilateral Affairs in the Counterterrorism Bureau, emphasized the cooperative relationship between the United States and the host countries in the ATA program.
We listen. We listen to what our partners need, what their specific concerns are, because they face unique situations in their countries and in their regions. We do build out partnership on equal footing because we have shared interests in confronting civilian security challenges.
Deputy Assistant Secretary Kabus noted that confronting terrorism is physically and emotionally demanding and that ATA trainers expect a lot from their students.
They create a safe environment to explore the ethics of the training, the strategy of the training, the tactics, the decision-making, and sharing of real-world experiences with our law enforcement partners and peers around the world.
Ms. Kabus underscored that a key component of the ATA program is an emphasis on professionalism and human rights. Maintaining the highest standard of professional conduct helps build trust and critical relationships with communities in which they serve, she said. Every ATA course that is offered around the world is required to provide human rights education. It's part of our training. It's part of who we are. As for the students, Deputy Assistant Secretary Kabus said, in an overwhelming majority of instances or countries, we have been afforded the opportunity to work with the best of the best that they have to offer, committed, dedicated public servants who are there to serve their country, their people, build trust within their communities, and to see the big picture, the need to counter terrorism for the benefit of all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.